This episode of Landmine Radio is sponsored by Guido's Pizza. Located on International Airport Road in Anchorage, Guido's has been serving the best pizza, pasta, sandwiches, and more since 1984. Guido's is open daily for dine-in service from 11 a.m. to midnight, and they do takeout and delivery until 2 a.m. Whether I'm dining in a Guido's or ordering for delivery, the hardest part for me is always choosing what to get because they have so many amazing items on their menu. If you're looking for a quick bite or want to order food for a big party, Guido's is the place to go. Tell them Jeff from the Landmine sent you. Okay, back here in Juneau with Michael Parker. We just met. How you doing?
How you doing? Good.
You just, we'll talk about this hearing in a little bit, but you just were at the House Resources Committee in one of the more kind of alive hearings I've seen in a, you and your coworker, you're with Narwhal,
right.
A smaller oil company,
yep.
Gave a very direct testimony, which I was afterwards commented that it's kind of refreshing to hear somebody say what they actually think.
Oh, thank you. Well, it was actually an oversight hearing. So it wasn't a typical House Resources Committee hearing. They scheduled an oversight hearing to address a particular problem that the committee saw, that we see as well. And so I was glad they were able to schedule it, and it was able to happen.
So a little background, I want to talk about your company and kind of the issue is this West Harrison Bay, which is in the North Slope, I guess, north of kind of Willow.
Directly north of Willow, and then 7 miles north of Willow.
And then a little bit, I guess, west of Picca, right?
Mm-hmm.
Northwest of Picca. So
that's right.
And you guys are saying is there? You think there's a lot of oil there?
Oh, yeah. It's, it's part of this revival of the North Slope. For decades, they hadn't found any oil other than Alpine, maybe that was a $200-300 million discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they had lost hope there would ever be a large discovery again. I mean, a la Kuparuk, a la Prudhoe Bay.
well, you got Bill Armstrong.
Well, that's what he changed everything.
And I actually wrote, this was kind of referenced in the hearing, but I wrote an article a few months back about Conoco and Santos and how Conoco is kind of bullying tactics over this road issue. But right. They used to have that lease. Mm-hmm. Up there, Picca, and then they missed it, and I'm sorry, Picca, and then Armstrong came in and found it. I think the drilling was a little different, and anyways, I mean that's a huge that horseshoe pick. I mean that's a lot of oil.
Well, I don't think they missed it. I just think they didn't think the oil was going to be productive. Usually, when you have oil at that depth, 4,000, 4,500 feet, it's biodegraded. If you get oxygen in oil, it becomes like this heavy viscous tar like. Even in California, where it's even better than you would expect at that depth here, they have to put diluent in it just to get it through a pipeline. So you'd imagine how hard it'd be to get that heavy viscous, bunker type fuel down the Trans-Alaskan pipeline. It'd be impossible.
Well, there was some, one of the articles, there was this guy, Joe Marushak, who was a former head of Conoco Alaska. He was pretty clear. He's like, we should have found that. We didn't really know, we didn't do the right thing. And then Armstrong came in and, I mean, I think it's 80,000, they're saying 80,000 barrels a day at least.
More than that.
There could be more, and there's other, plays in that region, which
yeah,
could be and then you got Willow, which Conoco does have. But before we go into the Harrison Bay thing with you and your company and Shell and these leases, what's your background? You said from Georgia, but you're originally in Dallas, right?
Yeah, originally from Savannah, Georgia.
You have that very distinct Georgia accent.
Thank you. I spent many years in New York. I was in the investment business there, investment management business, private equity, hedge funds. In 2006, I was considering moving back to Atlanta. I'm from Savannah, but Atlanta's close enough. And I had dinner with the chairman of one of my investors, Hicks Muse Tatton First.
What's that?
It's called Hicks Muse Tatton First. So the chairman was a guy named Tom Hicks. He owned the sports teams in Dallas. He owned the Stars, the hockey team. He owned the Rangers. He also owned a couple of other assets, including the Liverpool team and soccer team in England. And he really wanted to focus on his sports franchises. And so he was moving and starting something called Hicks Holdings. And the then chairman that took over, John Muse, said that because Tom's moving out, it's kind of a turnkey situation. I could move my fund down to Dallas. So I told the group we're going to move to Dallas instead of Atlanta. And I've been there ever since. It's been great.
And you were in New York before that?
Yep. 14 years.
So when did you, because now Narwhal, it's a smaller oil company. When did you, were you always in the oil business or was it?
No, investing? I always invested in oil business, among other in businesses. But the way I got into Alaska was prior to Narwhal. So I don't know if you are familiar with the Kalish drilling of Smith Bay.
Yeah, I know Kalish.
A little bit? Okay, so the way Kalish got to Alaska was because of me. Jim Musselman was a Hicks Muse portfolio company CEO, Triton Energy, and they sold it to Amarada Hess. And then he left to form a company called Kosmos, and he had the discovery on the Big Jubilee Field, West Coast Africa, and sold that, and he was forming Kalish to do something new. He was really interested in Alaska. And I had been pitched the Smith Bay leases by the current owner structure. And I wasn't comfortable with them as the operator. And so I mentioned that if I was going to get involved, I would want Jim to drill it. He had a lot of experience in drilling remote locations. So we pulled Jim in. Jim negotiated a JOA with a company called Nordak, which had the leases at the time. Very favorable for Jim. He had a 75% working interest, the remaining non-work
interest.
That's
a big working interest.
It's a bigger, and he carried them through exploration. It was an expensive exploration project. I stayed involved by buying, along with an investor in Australia, some convertible senior debt that Siri owned. Siri had funded a Cook Inlet well for Nordak, and it was in default. Bought it out of default.
I remember that.
Yeah.
That's a long time ago.
That was a long time ago. I ended up selling that convertible debt to a guy named John Paul DeJoria. You know who he is? He's the guy that started Paul Mitchell Studios and then Patron, which he sold for.
He was involved in Alaska oil and gas stuff?
Still is. He's who I sold our interest.
Because I know Amarada Hess. Everybody knows Amarada. I mean, that's a big court case that everybody talks about here, the Amarada Hess. But what's this guy's name?
John Paul DeJoria.
And he was Paul Mitchell and what else? And
well, he started Paul Mitchell, the healthcare or the hair care.
Yeah.
And then Patron? He bought Patron and sold it for, I don't know how many billions of dollars, $6 billion.
And I got to get this guy on the podcast.
You should get him on the podcast.
He sounds fascinating.
Anyway, I exited at that point, but I got interested in the fact that there may be some of these, what are called top sets, these shallower Brookian plays that were holding all this oil that people have been looking for decades. And so we started accumulating leases in Harrison Bay in 2016. And then the Nanushik Formation discoveries were announced in 2017. So we got really lucky.
I was going to say, this is right around the time that Armstrong.
Right. At the Horseshoe discovery.
Horseshoe pick, yeah.
So he had discovered Pika, the initial well in 13, but nobody paid any attention to it because they thought it maybe a little localized reservoir.
There was I'll send you the story I did on this road thing with Conoco, but there was a great hearing in 2013. He was in front of the Senate Resources Committee, Armstrong, and there was a lot of things he said, but maybe the most interesting was at one point they asked him about his challenges working with the big Conoco specifically on the slope and barriers and obstacles. And he said, my relationship with ConocoPhillips is that of Ike and Tina Turner. I'm Tina Turner. He said that like on the record. I mean, I went back and found, he said that, but he was kind of like you guys, he was so just, he actually started talking and he was like, I don't have slides. I'm kind of just shoot from the hip and I'm going to tell you what I think. And if you guys have questions, the senators were so enamored with like somebody who would just, he was the owner, right? He would just say shit. He would just say what he thought. And at one point he even joked that he had some other guy who was going to come with him, but he was worried he might go off the rails. And you could tell they were all like, what does that mean? If you're not off the rails, what does off the rails mean? But that was, he was talking about, and it was, if you go back and watch it, it was almost like he was just knew it was like an omen or like a prediction of, you know, he was saying if this stuff goes right and all these things happen correctly, there's so much, you know, oil to be found. And it took a couple of years, but he announced it.
Well, so he found a specific type of formation called a cliniform, which is unusual. Just to be very simple and very quick, imagine the Brooks Range uplift and you have all this erosion of sediments down onto a beach, and the beach is maybe 2-3 miles wide. And then you have what we called in fishing the drop off, but the geologists called a leading shelf edge. And some of this sand would kind of go down the leading shelf edge and gather in the bottom. And the bottom of it was called the Torok. And you have these fans of sand down there. And that's what we were going for at Smith Bay. That's what a lot of the drilling, newer drilling, was going for. But what he discovered is the beaches is where all the oil is. And typically you wouldn't have biodegradation at that shallow depth. But you had, as the water levels were changing, a bunch of mud get dumped on top of these beaches, became mudstone and what it's called a stratigraphic trap, but basically a big seal. And as the oil migrated up, it stayed in these beaches, and the beaches have really, really deep sand, 75, 250 feet deep of sand that just got saturated in oil. And the interesting thing, what caused ConocoPhillips to take an interest in Willow and everything else, is he drilled the first well at Pica, and then in 2016-17, he drilled a second well 20 miles south at Horseshoe, and he ran acoustic signals, and these he found out that these wells were in pressure communication with one another, indicating one giant 25-mile reservoir.
So not several, but just one big
just
one.
Just one huge tank of oil. And then everything changed. That's when everybody went nuts.
So you said, and again, Harrison Bay is north of Willow and right. Northwest of Pica. You had, I think it was you or your associate,
Stefan,
had said that this Harrison Bay could be a Kuparuk level of, is that, I mean, that?
I think so, yeah. If you include the unit and our leases, it could be that big, yes.
How much recoverable oil could that be? I mean,
3 billion barrels.
Wow. So that huge. I mean, you start looking at the tax implication or the revenue implication to the state, it's a lot of money.
You know, there's a company called Wood Mackenzie, or Wood Mac, mm-hmm. for short, and they've done
some stuff for the state, some analysis.
Yeah, they do. They evaluate every field in the world, and they're sort of the gold standard for that. And a lot of operators, because they want good information, they give a lot of their information, their G&G information, their geological information, the cost information. And so they model out all these on a sort of on a constant basis. So they use the same price of oil and everything else. And so they did a full-blown analysis of Pica and of Willow. And they did the same thing of West Harrison Bay. And they include in their modeling things like state royalties, state production taxes, the operating cost of transporting the oil to market, for example, the pipeline cost, the capital cost. And then they do the free cash flow analysis after tax, after royalties, after everything. And the economics of these projects are just unreal. That's why Stefan was mentioning, or I think it was maybe the chairman mentioning, that West Harrison Bay was the top global prospect for Shell.
So let's talk about that. So you know, I'm going to reference the hearing when I post the podcast, but I mean, that was just a very rare hearing. Tom McKay's the chair. He brought you guys up. He had been pretty clear throughout the hearing that he had offered. So Shell has a bunch of leases inside, and you guys have a bunch of leases on the outside. So your leases kind of go around mm-hmm. the Shell leases. Now Shell, for the folks listening, most people know they were here a long time ago. They were doing some offshore stuff in the Chukchi. They had that infamous kind of Kulik right. situation where they, I guess they wanted to get it out to avoid paying some tax, and it grounded.
Yep.
But Shell's been out of the state for
2016.
Yeah. Almost a decade.
Yep.
You know, they people who used to work there went down south, or they got other jobs, but they have all these leases still in this West Harrison Bay. And what you guys were talking about in the hearing, and what McKay was alluding to or getting at, was, you know, they aren't doing anything. There's even a letter they had provided to the committee saying, we're not going to testify, thank you, we're interested in kind of selling or partnering with somebody. And you guys have said you've been working, trying to work with them, trying to get an agreement. And maybe the bigger part of the story is the DNR, the Department of Natural Resources, hasn't, you've met with them for, sounds like years, mm-hmm. hasn't done anything, hasn't intervened or said, what are you doing? Because you do have a duty to develop. That's part of the lease. Right. You can't just hold it and wait and, you know, try to gamble and say if somebody, you know, wants to, you know, buy it and make some money. So how do we get to this point where you guys were invited to the committee to, and he had majority members like Representative Sadler and Representative Rauscher who were like pretty unhappy
right.
with what you guys were saying about the DNR and about Shell and about John Boyle, the DNR commissioner, not acting in the state's interest. So I guess talk about kind of a little history there and how we got to that hearing, which I thought was, I got a tip. Someone said you should go to this hearing, and I went, and I was not disappointed.
Well, it's a long story. I don't know how to really break it down, but I'll kind of give you a general overview about how we got to where we are today. So Shell bought these leases in 2012, and they were about to term out in 2022. And so in 2020, they, and for no other reason to extend the lease term and preserve their options, they unitized. But they were clear to the DNR.
What does that mean, unitized?
If you create one unit for all, like Peak as a unit, for example. So until you unitize, you just own a bunch of separate leases. Mm-hmm. When you unitize, it's treated as one giant lease.
Even just theirs or yours too?
We wanted them to include ours, but they declined. And so they just unitized theirs.
When did you all get your leases?
We got our leases starting in 16 and then got some more a few years later. And then the final group of leases we got last year.
Why didn't Shell get those? Did they try to, or?
They didn't have the internal authorization to expand their network or their footprint in Alaska.
I mean, shit, you'd think if you had those ones, you'd want to get the ones next to it.
They did want them. They were upset that we got them. And then in the beginning, when we first got them, they wanted to work with us. But things changed when they tried to run it up the flagpole and got the feedback from people in The Hague and London, higher ups. I mean, the thing about the frustrating thing for Shell, I'm sure, is the local guys, the guys in Houston, want to drill this. But it's the CEO and the board of directors that are prohibiting
it. Is this like this ESG, carbon neutral, this kind of stuff? Yeah.
Well, so the two things happened in 2016. First of all, they had a disaster in the Chukchi Sea with the Berger well, the $9 billion loss in one well. I think it's the worst ever in history. But then
how much,
you had
$9 billion?
$9 billion they lost trying to drill out there. $9 billion.
And I knew it was a lot. I didn't realize it was. I knew they lost a lot. I didn't realize it was nine. Jesus.
Most expensive well in history, I think. But at the same time, you had in Europe, they passed the Paris Climate Accords, and you started this huge sort of tsunami of environmental activism in Europe. And the difference between Shell and ConocoPhillips is that these environmental activists are a substantial part of their shareholder base. And so constantly, including
the Shell base compared to Conoco.
That's right. You know, Shell shareholders don't want them to be an oil company, whereas ConocoPhillips shareholders do. And so
Exxon too, I would imagine.
And Exxon too. And so what happens is in these meetings, you can go back and Google it, you have these riots. You have to have people protecting the board of directors. They're trying to attack them. People are super gluing themselves to chairs. They got to haul them out. And
absolute lunatics. I just saw this lunatics. Thing. It might have been a Gaza type thing, but it was they're blocking the Seattle airport.
Right.
This is like recently. And then you still have some of these absolute fucking lunatics, and they're degrading artwork, you know, and Europe, and like, you know,
hurling soup against the Mona Lisa.
It's the same priceless group. Irreplaceable. Luckily some of them have covers on them, but I mean they're doing this. It's just absolutely, it's just nuts. And how people, some people just want to tolerate it.
At this AGM, it's just not these random activists. The largest shareholders of Shell have retained a proxy firm called Follow This. And they're putting forth resolutions at their annual shareholder meeting to enforce these kind of environmental priorities. And they're getting huge amounts of the vote. That if they were to try to drill in the Arctic again, there's some theoretical possibility that one of these groups like Rothschild Asset Management would start a full-blown proxy war and try to throw their board out and hire another CEO. So they're under a tremendous amount of pressure not to do something like drill in the Arctic.
Well, I guess, you know, from my perspective, if they want to hold the lease and not risk, you know, losing a big discovery, that's okay. But the state should be a check. And they haven't, it sounds like you guys have had meetings with, and this is why McKay's hearing was so interesting, because it was more of an oversight hearing. But, you know, as a majority member, McKay, when he has other majority members very uncomfortable with what you guys were saying, this kind of thing doesn't, I mean, the House, I don't know if you pay attention to our legislature. The House is a little bit loose. It's an understatement. But in this case, you know, that Resources Committee normally runs a little more functionally.
Well, I mean, we just told the truth. And the reality is Shell could do whatever they want their leases until their leases expired. And or they went into default of their obligations, their legal obligations under the unit agreement. And then they should go to the DNR and they should renegotiate what their expectations are. They didn't do that. Now it's just drifting. No one's doing anything. And I think that's by design. But 16 months is an unprecedented amount of time for a company to be materially out of compliance with its unit agreement and its plan of expiration, and the DNR doing nothing about it. I mean, the DNR is the state landlord. Shell is a tenant. They're in default of the lease. DNR needs to do something about it. They either need to renegotiate the terms of the lease or they need to hold the lease in default.
Now, you both had said that you had met with DNR many times. And they were indicated they were going to send a default or I guess a non-compliance letter, but they haven't.
Right.
Why do you think you guys had stated some reasons in the committee, but I guess maybe why do you think they haven't done that?
So I don't think that the DNR was being upfront with us or the committee or anybody else. I think that they pay lip service to the fact that they want to expedite drilling and they're going to pretend like they're going to impose some conditions on Shell. But then they meet with Shell lobbyists and nothing happens. And then months go by and you ask them why these letters never went out or why this communication never happened. And then you're kind of back to the exact place you were before. And they're like, oh, we're going to do it now. And we've been through this repetitive cycle literally for almost 2 years with the DNR now.
I mean, it's one thing if it's Conoco or even Exxon's not super involved. I mean, they have a few people up here, but it's one thing if it's Conoco or Exxon for people that are kind of, especially Conoco. You know, they're here and, okay, you're a little worried about the big boys might want to, you know, do something. But Shell's not even here.
Right.
They left.
Not only they leave, they say they're never coming back.
Yeah, no,
they will never come back to Alaska. They publicly state that.
So what can you guys do right now as far as exploration and development with your leases without having Shell's cooperation? Or, I mean, can you still make a move? Or, I mean, how much more advantageous would it be if you guys had Shell cooperating or access to those leases?
Well, we plan on drilling our own leases. We don't need Shell's leases to be able to develop. We've got more acres than they do. And so we've got an enormous amount of resource. But, I mean, you saw the map. I mean, mm-hmm. We could divide the bay, basically. The issue, as I mentioned to the committee, comes in development. To develop a huge new basin, a new field, remote field, is incredibly expensive. Just look how much ConocoPhillips is spending on Willow and how much Pika is.
$10 billion.
Yeah, it's just enormously expensive. And so the question is, why would you want to build all that infrastructure on half the bay instead of 100% of it? Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be us with 100% of it. Just two companies like Repsol and Santos. Two companies, you know, used to be ConocoPhillips and Anadarko. Two companies that sign a JOA and agree to a cooperative, sensible...
That's joint operating agreement.
Yeah, joint operating agreement, plan of attack. And even if it's completely separate, you don't even need to unitize the whole thing. We could all jointly decide where the roads are going to be, where the pipelines are going to be. We're going to agree to share them, the production facility. You'll have to build one of them. And it reduces the cost for each of the parties massively.
So are you guys more like... I'm just guessing you probably don't have $10 billion to develop all of it. Are you guys more like a Armstrong, or like a Great Bear? I guess a smaller, but once you find
it. Like an Armstrong. We'll get through.
Because Bill found it, but he didn't. He sold it, obviously, right. And Pika, but he found it. He said, hey, I got something really, really great here.
Yeah. I think we plan to explore, and then maybe we take a strategic partner, an industry partner, for the appraisal process. You know, after you find it, you got to drill it out, like find out exactly, delineate the formation, how big it is and everything else. That's a 2-year process. We'll probably have an industry partner for that. And then once it goes final investment decision, FID, that's when you decide, okay, we fully appraised it. It's time to build the infrastructure. At that point, we probably should exit and keep an override or something like that, because you're talking about capital calls on $9 billion mm-hmm. per year.
So these are offshore, mm-hmm. which is different than an onshore. So what is a drilling season? I mean, your drilling season is different than if it's onshore, right?
A little bit, yeah.
Exploration.
The good thing is it's very shallow out there. If you look at the bathymetry, it's 2 feet deep where we're drilling. And so it's not going to melt fast, but it will melt. And so we need to be out of there by April-ish before the water starts melting and our equipment and rig will be on the bottom of the ocean.
So the plan is to, I guess, next year?
We were hoping to get out this coming winter.
Like so in 9 months or whatever?
In like 9 months, but that's looking increasingly unlikely because we haven't got our permits yet. We moved some well locations around, so our long lead permits haven't been issued, and they need to get issued quickly because we want to stage equipment during the summer. If we can't stage equipment during the summer, it delays everything. It probably limits the amount of drilling.
Do you guys have a drilling partner or somebody you have like lined up?
Yeah, we have a bunch of operating guys, but we haven't decided on what rigs we're going to lease and who's going to drill it yet.
How big, for the folks listening, how big is Narwhal? How many people work there? Do you have people in Alaska or is it all kind of Texas?
We have people in Alaska, but so our partners are, we've got several partners, but we really need to build our internal team. I mean, we're going to use consultants, outside consultants for a lot of this stuff, but we do need an internal team. We have a pretty good operating team, but we need to hire some geologists and geophysicists and geoscientists and some others. But
when you stated you think it's a big potential field, is there any data, any wells or any seismic or anything to indicate that? Or is it based on the kind of willow pick a?
No, there's seismic. So we bought all the available seismic and we had it reprocessed and we had it reanalyzed. And we compared it against willow. There's particularly Pika, because there's a lot of public information about Pika. Willow, Conoco hasn't disclosed as much as Santos and Oil Search and Armstrong did over the years. And it's pretty easy to delineate these formations once you get an idea of what they look like.
So the other thing that was interesting, you guys had said, and I thought about this a lot afterwards, and I think this is probably true. Shell used to be in Guyana, which there was a major discovery. Actually, there was a video floating around last month of the president schooling this. Sorry, I have this damn speaker that makes these weird sounds sometimes. The president kind of went viral for schooling a BBC guy saying, oh my God, if you develop this stuff. And he was saying, we have forests. We've never cut down our forests. Why do you guys go develop all the oil? But Shell had this leases, and they left, and Exxon took over. And they found, I didn't realize, $11 billion?
In Guyana, in Central America.
Yeah, Guyana, so Central America.
Yeah. There's up to $11 billion now, but even right after the discovery, it was something like 1.3 billion barrels. And Shell exited it, and I think it was a very international, it was very well known in the oil and gas community. I think it was very embarrassing for them. And at this point, I think they just don't want a repeat of that situation.
So you think the potential or the situation is they don't want to have another one of these happen where they leave and then somebody else comes in and says, oh shit, 3 billion barrels. Like,
Fourth largest conventional oil field ever discovered in North America, and we just walked away.
Did you see the video of the president of Guyana there like a month ago? The BBC interview, and he was essentially saying, if you develop all this oil, there's going to be all the carbon release. And the guy just went off and said, we have this forest, we haven't ever cut it down. You guys have, since the Industrial Revolution, have developed all, like, why do you guys get to do all this and we can't? We can't.
Well, Alaska totally is the same thing.
Totally schooled the guy on it.
I'm sure Alaska with this big forest is net zero too. So why are they picking on Alaska? The other point I make about Alaska is, you know, the environmentalists love to pick on Alaska, but oil makes a big difference to Alaska. They ought to pick on Texas, or even though I'm Texas, or Colorado, where it's not that important to people. If you were to take away the oil industry in Alaska, you would destroy a lot of lives. It's too Absolutely. Critical to the environment, and it doesn't make sense that you would pick on the state that needs it the most. Why don't you pick on a place? Because it doesn't matter where you drill it.
I think Alaska is a kind of gem to these kind of extreme environmentalists. It's very easy to show this pristine parts of, even most of it, not even near the oil.
Right.
You know, like Denali or the whatever you show. And it just becomes kind of this symbol. And you get, you know, they raise money off of it and they do all these, campaigns for it. But, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's not just the ink. I mean, it means a lot of money depending on the price of oil. The state gets money from that. But the whole whole reason the permanent fund exists is because of the oil revenues. Without the oil revenues over the last 40 some, you know, years, 50, almost 50 years, there would be no permanent fund. And this is actually the whole reason we became a state, was they didn't want to make us a state. They were like, we don't want to. That's way too much. We're going to be a big liability. But then they found oil, and that was the kind of reason that the Congress agreed to make us a state. So it's incredible how short-sighted some people are with the state. And I mean, some of them want and they've, the really extreme ones will say this. They want to just stop the oil and they want to see an exodus of people leave. Some of them will say that. Not all of them will say that.
Right.
But that's the extreme. That's the position I think most of them feel, but they won't, not all of them will say it.
Well, hopefully their voices get muted out, more reasonable voices.
Well, if Willow eventually comes on and, you know, Pica, that's combined, I think, you know, 150,000 barrels or more. And then there's other.
More than that.
It could be, you know, I think it's funny that they always.
Pica's 80,000 barrels a day and it's $120,000 for barrels. Willow, but I think 180,000 barrels for, but I think they're both way lowballing, especially Willow. Well, they had to get approval from the Biden administration. The last thing they wanted to do is overstate.
Well, I was going to say, I've talked to people that are not part of those companies, but they've you know been pretty clear. Like, these companies always underplay. They're public companies. They, you know, better to under promise and over deliver than make these, you know, the biggest claims you can make, and then the expectations get set. So I think there's a lot more potential in both of those.
I mean, I think Shell ought to do the right thing and just leave Alaska if they can't drill. I mean, it's they're holding up these leases that could be developed by somebody else because they're worried about reputational damage if somebody discovers oil. I think they should get over that and move on, or drill the well. If they want to get approval to drill from the board of directors, I don't think it'll happen. We'd love them as a partner. We'd love them in West Harrison Bay. But so, that's never going to happen with the environmental activists that control their board of directors.
So what's your best case scenario? Is DNR says, hey, you guys need to fucking do something or we're taking the lease away. And then
the DNR just needs to do its job. And they said they're going to do their job, but they haven't done their job. The DNR is a landlord. That's what they are. They're the landlord of state leases. You've got a very important lease in default. They need to tell Shell, you're in default. We'll give you a reasonable cure period. And here's ways you can cure your default. You can either drill, or you can find somebody else to drill, or come up with some creative solution that, you know, results in the exploration of West Harrison Bay. If you can't do that within some set period of time, whether it's 90 days or 180 days or whatever, then we should all agree that it's the best interest for one and all for you just to move on to an area where you are authorized to drill and you don't have these restrictions.
This is not something that's never happened before. The DNR has in the past said to people, hey, you know, you can't just sit here and do nothing. You have to.
Not when they're in default. You know, I don't think the DNR has a lot of authority when someone's complying with their contractual obligations, but when they're in default, then they can do whatever they want. I mean, it's no different than your landlord here in your office. If you don't pay your rent, I mean, it's only a matter of time before you would think the owner of the building would have the building manager say, why haven't you written the guy a letter saying he needs to pay his rent?
Unless you're one of those squatters in California. You see those stories in California that people move into these houses and they don't, I mean, they leave, they stay there for like months or years and don't leave. It's crazy.
But, I know.
But good, yeah.
Well, if Narwhal doesn't work out, I'm going to try that maybe in Colorado.
Yeah, maybe just find a nice place in Aspen.
I'll be a squatter.
Winter Park.
In Aspen.
So how do you feel? How do you feel? I mean, the hearing went, your expectations.
I think it went really well. I mean, I think that my view about something like this is just to be brutally honest. You know, a lot of people.
Well, you lived up to that. You got an A plus on that.
And then the ships can fall where they may. I mean, I think the DNR is going to have particularly the commissioner is going to have a really hard time explaining his behavior, why he's been so lenient to Shell when he's been so tough on other smaller operators. And, you know, I told you why I think that is. And I think that Shell probably has to look in the mirror and decide, really want to keep doing this to the people of Alaska. And,
you know, John, I know John, I like John. John knows his business. He used to work for, you know, Oil Search in Santos. So he like knows this business and he knows what it, you know, he's the DNR commissioner now, but he knows how it is to have another company, Conoco. And this is a decision before him, but the DNR came out and said, you know, Conoco can't shake down Santos for this road usage. Right. This is like ongoing, you know, so he knows about this stuff. And I think now he has to definitely, there's no way he doesn't come to the committee now after that hearing. That's going to,
I don't know. He was given a lot of notice about this, and he knew exactly what we were going to talk about. It was previewed, and we've personally had a lot of conversations with John Boyle and John Crowther, and they know exactly what we feel about it. And we're just blunt with them as we were with the committee today. And he had to think that was going to happen today.
Well, McKay, McKay said, I don't know how many times, many times, he kept saying, I assure you to the members, I assure you that DNR was aware, made aware of this, was invited. I think he said months. He spent months trying to get, so it didn't.
Well, some of these hearings were postponed. I mean, we postponed them because they wanted to give the DNR more time. But at the end of the day, I don't think the DNR was there because I don't think there's any justification for their behavior, and they're probably embarrassed and trying to figure out some excuse for why they've given these accommodations to Shell over the last 2 years.
Well, I enjoyed hearing it, and I've said this a long time. I mean, I'm very, I think we should develop our oil. I think we should develop our resources. And the problem sometimes is, you know, people that are very pro-development sometimes see the state as, you know, an opposition, whereas, you know, the oil companies and the state are aligned for the most part, but sometimes they aren't aligned. And when you're like a pro-oil person, you don't want the state to take action sometimes. Sometimes the state has to take action. You know, they aren't always aligned. I mean, they are, after all, on separate sides of the table. Now, they all have the same outcome, but once in a while, when you get to a point where something's not happening, the state needs to, you know, take a hard stance and do something.
Right.
And I think a lot of people that are pro-development are very nervous to have the state do things like that because it looks like the heavy hand of the state getting involved. But I mean, people need that. Well, that needs to happen. Sometimes.
That might have been the case 16 months ago, but now it's getting to be ridiculous.
I just mean in general, you know, in general, where you have people that are just nervous to, right, you know, have the state do things that might seem heavy-handed. But you know, it's like we have to look at the people in the legislators, the governor. They have to look out for the state of Alaska.
Well, let me tell you something. It's not heavy-handed at all. It's my understanding that one of the Shell executives went to the DNR and spoke to John Boyle, John Crowther, and told him he already has internal authorization to relinquish and that they're ready to go. They're ready to exit. The DNR said, we're not going to call your hand on this. You don't need to, which is outrageous. But that's my understanding of what happened.
Well, if that's true, that's real wild. I mean, that really needs to be.
Well, I heard it directly from John Crowther.
Wow, he's deputy commissioner of DNR. Wow. Well, I think after that hearing, I think there's no chance they don't come in and testify and get something on the record. So
I hope so.
Well, for the folks listening, again, Michael Parker, Narwhal, what's your title there?
I'm kind of one of the an owner, I'm a manager.
And then the other guy was
Stefan Labonte. He's a manager too. He used to be the manager of.
He was a former Shell guy. I looked at his.
He ran North America. That's how I met him. Is because he on the other side of the table was. We were negotiating, you know, buying their leases over the years and everything. And he was always the guy on the other side. And he saw that it was such a good project for Shell that he jumped ship and decided to join us and run it. So he's going to be our CEO.
I went to his LinkedIn. I think he worked at Shell for like 15 years, holding various. I mean, North America. So
he ran. You know. He ran Canada. He ran Alaska. He's run all kinds. Major projects all over.
So, I mean, if anybody knows what's going on, he probably has a pretty good idea. Well, Mike, it was great meeting you and talking to you. And I'll link the hearing in the podcast. And I encourage folks listening to watch that because it was like I said, a refreshing, honest take in a place where sometimes people aren't very forthcoming and honest about how they feel or what they think.
Right. So thanks, Jeff.
Thanks again. Yeah, Michael Parker from Narwhal. Appreciate you coming on. Folks, if you have an idea for a podcast or want to do a podcast, get a hold of me and stay tuned for the next one. Landline.